Clark was a leading inspiration behind the publication, The Openness of God, which came out 16 years ago, 1994, from InterVarsity Press. Since that book was published, the position presented there has been the object of extensive analysis, vigorous criticism, and a rather wide range of characterizations. The harsher voices asserted that open theism undermines biblical Christianity and call on Christian leaders to declare it beyond the bounds of Orthodox Christian teaching. The attractions of open theism, one of them insists, come only at the cost of God's majesty. As some see it, anything other than all-inclusive determinism and exhaustive foreknowledge is incompatible with divine sovereignty, God's most important quality. We see this in such titles as No Place for Sovereignty, What's Wrong with Free Will Theism, and Still Sovereign, Contemporary Perspectives on Election, Foreknowledge, and Grace. In time, the rhetoric became less strident and the assessment of open theism more measured. Although a few, like Fernando Canali, regard open theism as a slightly modified version of process theism, others, including such diverse figures as David Griffin and John Cooper, to mention a process and a Reformed theologian in the same sentence, recognize that it is not a species of process theology. Instead, says Cooper, open theism should be viewed as revised classical theism, since it retains a supernatural view of God's existence, power, revelation, and acts in history. In the same vein, Stephen Roy describes open theism as a variation on classical Arminian theology. Now, along with considerable criticism, open theism has also generated a measure of appreciation. Among its critics, there are those who concede that despite its alleged deficiencies, open theism has made important contributions to theological discussion. According to Bardeen scholar Bruce McCormick, for example, what is valuable in the open theistic proposal is its critique of a putative divine impassibility and timelessness. Even a contributor to the book entitled God Under Fire, Modern Scholarship Reinvents God, lists several lessons to be learned from open theism, including the importance of affirming the relationality of God and reevaluating the doctrine of divine impassibility. Now, the issue before us today concerns a way of characterizing open theism that is popular across a broad spectrum of theological scholars, including both its critics and its supporters. Now, as the examples on the handout you've received indicate, whenever open theism is under discussion, the word limit in one form or another almost always seems to appear. And I'll sort of go from, critics to supporters in that order. In Does God Take Risks? James Spiegel's summary of the open view of providence includes the statement that God's power is limited by human freedom. And we can compare Paul Helm's characterization of open theism as presenting a God that is bound by time. Okay. In one of the last paragraphs of his nicely toned study, What Does God Know and When Does He Know It?, Millard Erickson characterizes open theism as endorsing limited foreknowledge as opposed to the traditional view of exhaustive divine foreknowledge. Gary Dorian attributes to proponents of the openness of God the classical Arminian position, in which God is viewed as having limited his power in relation to the world in order to give his creatures freedom to live and flourish within it. According to Bruce McCormick, limited divine foreknowledge is foundational to open theology. Open theists abandon the ideas of divine timelessness and impassibility, he asserts, and as a logical consequence of limited divine foreknowledge and a mode of relating to the world that is characterized by affectivity and reciprocity. Roger Olson is here, so I'll choose my words carefully, but I would describe Roger Olson not as a critic of open theism so much as a sympathetic and friendly observer and conversation partner. I'll let him distance himself from those comments if he chooses. But one thing I've always appreciated about Roger is his spirit of convivial Christian conversation as opposed to animated criticism. But in an online piece entitled God's Self-Limitation, Professor Olson identifies the idea that God limits himself in creation as in incarnation an important presupposition of classical Arminian theology and of open theism. God's power is limited, according to Olson, because he chooses to limit it. Although we could enjoy omnipotence, he elects not to for the sake of having real rather than imaginary relations with human persons. Moreover, only if God limits his power in relation to creation can he avoid responsibility for evil. Divine determinism inevitably makes God the author of sin and evil. Clark Pinnock, the foremost proponent of open theism, uses limit language in an attempt to show the similarities between open theism and other theological positions. The openness model is not alone in positing libertarian freedom of divine self-limitation of power to make room for the creature. It's not unusual for contemporary theologians to speak of divine self-limitation or kenosis, whereby God freely chooses to allow the world to impact him without, however, losing his lordship over it. The openness model, he continues, echoes many themes of the theology of hope, which recognizes a God who, once again, limits himself in creating a world which has the capacity to affect him without his losing lordship over it. Finally, Philip Clayton, not an evangelical theologian, but someone who develops a position he calls open panentheism, interesting constellation of terms, which involves the notion of a freely self-limiting God. As Clayton describes his position, it draws on a number of features from open theism, including creation ex nihilo and the free self-limitation of God. So both critics and supporters of open theism resort to limit language when they describe the openness of God. Open theists hold that God created beings who enjoy genuine or radical freedom, and God acquires knowledge of their decisions when and as they are made, not before. In creating such a world, as they often phrase it, God limits both his power and his knowledge. For its supporters, these characteristics constitute a self-limitation. God expresses kenotic love by voluntarily restricting the range of his power and knowledge. For its critics, these aspects of open theism impose unacceptable restrictions on God. Calvinists reject the notion that either God's power or knowledge is limited. Traditional Arminians accept a limited view of divine power, but they reject the notion that God's knowledge is limited. Like Calvinists, they affirm or endorse exhaustive divine foreknowledge. Now, pervasive though limit language is in discussions of open theism, my contention is that open theists should avoid such language entirely in their descriptions of God, on the grounds that it is both unnecessary and misleading. Open theists can make their points effectively without employing the notion of limits. And more important, the use of limit language tends to obscure the positive features of the divine reality which open theism seeks to emphasize. And so you'll find there, tersely, I hope succinctly listed, five reasons why open theists should not use limit language. And I think I can say they're in ascending order of importance, all right? A preliminary reason to avoid limit language is the fact that the very word limit carries negative connotations. To describe something as limited suggests that it is inferior to or less than something similar that is unlimited. When applied to God, the word limits or limited has pejorative connotations. It conjures up a God who is restricted, hampered in what he can do and know. Indeed, a God who is decidedly inferior to the more robust alternatives that Christians traditionally embrace. If we think of God along traditional lines as the greatest conceivable being, the very notion of a limited God will seem oxymoronic. When open theists use limit language for their view of God, therefore, when they describe God's power and knowledge as limited, they invite the criticism that open theism suffers in comparison to classical theism, which attributes to God unlimited power and absolute foreknowledge. So it's little wonder that classical theists find their view of God superior. A second reason to avoid or reject limit language brings us to the most widespread objection to open theism, namely its view of divine foreknowledge. One of the most prevalent descriptions of open theism may also be the least accurate, namely the idea that it limits God's knowledge or holds to the concept of limited foreknowledge. Now, the question of divine foreknowledge has perplexed Arminians from the time of Arminius himself. Arminius departed from Calvinism with an affirmation of human freedom, but he had no coherent alternative to the Calvinist account of divine foreknowledge. According to Calvin, God knows the future infallibly because he determines it exhaustively. Nothing happens outside his eternal decrees, and since God foresees future events only by reason of the fact that he decreed that they take place, it is clear that all things take place by his determination and bidding. Like Calvin, Arminius affirms God's absolute foreknowledge, but unlike Calvin, he has no way to account for it. The knowledge of God, he states, is eternal, immutable, and infinite, and extends to all things both necessary and contingent. But, he says, I do not understand the mode in which he knows future contingencies, and especially those which belong to the free will of creatures. Arminius rejected divine determinism, but affirmed exhaustive divine foreknowledge. But if humans enjoy libertarian freedom, freedom to do otherwise, how could God know their decisions in advance? Arminius admitted that he didn't know. And Arminians have wrestled with the question ever since. How can God infallibly foresee the content of future free decisions? In an article that appeared over 20 years ago, I argued that none of the proposed attempts to affirm coherently both free will and absolute divine foreknowledge are satisfying. One of the most familiar is the view that God stands outside time, so past, present, and future are all alike to him. Another is middle knowledge, or Molinism, according to which God knows not only all actualities and all possibilities, he also knows conditional future contingent events. That is to say, he knows everything each individual would do in all conceivable circumstances, or in all possible worlds, to use a favorite expression. And because God also knows which of these possibilities is actual, because he created this world, he therefore knows what all the future free decisions of the creatures in this world will be. A third response is to deny the question of divine foreknowledge and human freedom really requires an answer. If my knowledge of past events doesn't cause them, why should God's knowledge of future events mean that they are somehow caused or inevitable? Now, for open theists, the best response to the problem of freedom and foreknowledge is not to solve it, but to dissolve it, to show that there is no such problem. If future free decisions do not become real or do not exist until they occur, there is no need to explain how God could know them because prior to their occurrence, there is nothing there to know. And to those who maintain that this constitutes an unacceptable truncation of divine knowledge, open theists respond that omniscience, perfect knowledge, by definition includes every possible object of knowledge. So the question is not the scope, let alone the excellence of divine knowledge, but the status of future free decisions. If they are knowable, then God knows them, period. If they are not there to know until they occur, it implies no deficiency in God's knowledge to say that it does not include them. Not because God's knowledge leaves something out, but because in the case of future free decisions, there is nothing to include. For open theists, the logic of omniscience closely parallels that of omnipotence. Most theologians who attribute omnipotence to God, from Thomas Aquinas to C.S. Lewis, define it not as the ability to do anything, period, fill in the blank with anything you please, but as the ability to do anything logically possible. This avoids attributing nonsense to God along the lines of drawing square circles, creating married bachelors, or making 2 and 2 equal 5. According to this generally accepted view of omnipotence, God cannot do such things not because he lacks the power to do so, but because these expressions do not refer to anything doable. Being logical absurdities, they have no reference. Now, if it makes good sense to define omnipotence in terms of logical possibility, it makes good sense to define omniscience the same way. Omnipotence does not include what is logically undoable. Omniscience does not include what is logically unknowable. To quote John Sanders, if omnipotence following Aquinas is defined as the ability to do all that is logically possible, and if this is not an attenuated understanding of divine power, then why should omniscience defined as knowing all that is logically possible to know be an attenuated view of divine knowledge? He adds, nobody calls Aquinas' definition of omnipotence limited omnipotence. It's misleading, then, to describe open theism as endorsing a concept of limited foreknowledge, let alone as resting on it. There's nothing limited about God's knowledge, according to open theism. God's knowledge is perfect or all-inclusive. The crucial question is what there is to know. Open theism holds that future free decisions do not exist until they occur, and then they enter God's knowledge. As John Sanders refers to it, I think in a happy expression, God enjoys dynamic omniscience. Thus, open theism avoids the conundrum of classical Arminianism, and that is vainly trying to reconcile foreknowledge and free will. It would not be inaccurate to describe open theism as the quest for consistent Arminianism. Three, another reason to avoid limit language to describe God is the fact that it denotes nothing distinctive about open theism. There's an important sense in which the notion of limits applies just as well to other views of God, including the Calvinist. Open theists believe that God had a choice when it came to creation. God could have created a world in which he determined everything that happens. In other words, God had the power to create the sort of world that Calvinists endorse. But, open theists believe, God also had the option of creating a world in which some of the creatures would contribute to the ongoing course of events by making choices not determined by God. In other words, God could create a world in which some of the creatures enjoy libertarian freedom. In one world, God decides everything. In the other, both God and the creatures make decisions. If both worlds are possible, then which of the two worlds actually exists depends on God's sovereign choice. As John Sanders puts it, God is the sovereign determiner of the sort of sovereignty he will exercise. God is free to sovereignly decide not to determine everything that happens in history. It's also important to note that the choice between these options is genuine only if the two worlds are significantly different. A significant choice presupposes genuine alternatives, and real alternatives involve different consequences. After all, not all goods are compossible or simultaneously realizable. In choosing between these options, therefore, God embraces the values available in one, but not the other. Either way, God's decision involves a limitation of sorts, if you insist on that language. The values in a divinely determined world, such as absolute certainty that God's purposes will be precisely fulfilled, are not available in a world where the creatures enjoy libertarian freedom. By the same token, the values available in a world where the creatures enjoy libertarian freedom would not be available in a world where God's decisions or decrees are all determining. The question that divides Calvinists from open theists and other Arminians is, which of these two worlds did God create? But either way, limitations are involved. An interesting question for Calvinists is whether the world of open theism represents a genuine possibility. Could God, if God chose, create a world containing creatures who enjoy libertarian freedom? Well, if Calvinists answer no, then we have identified something that God lacks the ability to do. And unless such a world is as logically contradictory as a square circle, a flat-out logical impossibility, then God's inability to create such a world would represent a significant limitation on God's power. On the other hand, if the answer is yes, that is, if indeed God has the power to create a world with an open future, then the question that divides Calvinists and open theists, as well as other Arminians, is not what sort of power does God have, but what sort of world could God create? The real question that divides them, then, is what sort of world did God create? And perhaps why would God create this particular world? So we have questions about the possibility, the probability, and the actuality of divine decision. I think I'm supposed to be done in half an hour, right? Okay. A further reason, turning to the fourth there, a further reason for open theists to avoid limit language in describing God concerns the nature of divine power. According to open theism, as well as Arminianism in general, God endows the creatures with the capacity to exercise freedom, make choices, contribute to the ongoing course of events. As it is sometimes put, God shares his power with the creatures or makes room in his life for their experience. And this is often expressed as a self-limitation on God's part. God gives up a measure of divine power so the creatures can have a measure of their own. There are several problems, however, with this construal of divine and creaturely power. For one thing, it presupposes a zero-sum distribution of power in the world, according to which there is only so much power to go around. Consequently, God can only grant the creatures power by giving up some of his own. And the more power God lets the creatures have, then the less power God has for himself. But why should we think of power this way? Why don't we think of God as limiting his happiness or his love? We don't think of God as limiting his happiness or his love, for example, by creating creatures who are capable of these qualities. What compels us to think of power this way? Then there is the way in which God manifests his power in a world where there are other agents, too, who have power. There are good reasons to think that such a world involves a greater display of divine power than one in which God determines everything. First of all, such a world may express God's nature more fully and more adequately than one in which he decides everything by himself. In addition, open theists believe that it requires a greater manifestation of power or a higher kind of power for God to accomplish his purposes in a world where he takes the choices of others into account than in a world where he made all the decisions by himself. To risk a personal example, I tried for years to play classical music on the piano and later on a brass instrument. The challenge was always to play the notes exactly as written, to fulfill the composer's intentions precisely. That was my goal. I never did it, but I tried. Years later, I joined a jazz group thinking that jazz performers had a much less difficult task. After all, they weren't bound by a score that prescribed or determined ahead of time the notes.